Okay, good morning, everyone. Thanks for attending session 323, DNC cover to cover, inside and outside. Before we begin, just a few announcements. We ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. The session is being recorded and you will have the chance to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine and podcast at the registration desk as well. The session is an hour long, and we ask that both audience and presenters keep within that framework so that we can allow for the next session to start on time. As you can see from your programs, this presentation description is as follows. A secular Mormon and a non-Mormon teamed up to read the Doctrine and Covenants cover to cover on a podcast, giving an insider's and outsider's perspective on Mormon canon and history. What did they learn from this endeavor? Bryce Blankenagel is a full-time researcher and contributor to the realbookofmormon.org, co-host of My Book of Mormon podcast, and host, editor-producer of the Naked Mormonism podcast. He's a fan of history and can't get enough of the 19th century American variety. Marie Kent grew up in a pastor's family and is a podcast and history fanatic working in the healthcare industry. What little spare time remains after caring for her two wonderful boys, Marie fills with extroverted socializing through knitting groups, weekly get-togethers, and hosting, editing, producing her podcast, My Book of Mormon. So we'll now turn the time over to them.
Welcome to My Book of Mormon podcast. I'm your host, Marie Kent.
And I'm the co-host, Bryce Blankenagel.
And everyone, thank you for coming, because we are going to talk about having read the Doctrine and Covenants every week for the last 2 years.
It's 2 years.
2 years, yes. Okay, show of hands.
It kind of flew by, didn't it?
Flew
a little bit.
Flew by very slowly. All right, show of hands. Who here has read the DNC? Who here has read every single chapter in chronological order of the DNC? Okay, all right, we got some. All right.
How many of you studied the Doctrine and Covenants outside of mission prep?
Oh my gosh, look at everybody raising their hands. This is amazing.
It's like we're in a conference that centers around Mormon history.
Yeah, so that means that all of you know exactly what we're going to talk about, because you've all read every single chapter of the DNC. Yes.
Yeah.
So first off, let's talk about ourselves. So yes, as you heard, I'm a mom. I have two little boys. And I love to study history, as we all do. I think that if Joseph Smith is the divine prophet of God, well, we should read everything that he has ever wrote, right? Am I right? You nod your heads. Yes, we should read everything he wrote. Yeah, and so we need to know everything that our kids are learning in primary. We need to know all the songs, or the popcorn pops on the apricot tree. You know, like, you need all of that, right? Right? So I am not a Mormon, and I did not grow up Mormon. I was raised Baptist. And so, like, I'm like, these things that I'm saying, I don't actually know what they mean. I just know that there are phrases that you're supposed to say.
If anyone doesn't know the shtick, doesn't know, you know, have never listened to the show, whatever, how did you come into this wacky world of reading through Mormon scripture? Because most people wouldn't consider that a fun hobby.
Those people are wrong. Yeah, so what happened is that my Book of Mormon podcast was started by a really great guy. His name was David Michael. And he thought, as a never Mormon, he should be able to pick up the Book of Mormon and learn about everything Mormonism by reading their holy texts.
He was wrong.
He was wrong. So I was, at the time, I was a runner, and so a friend had turned me onto this podcast, and so I'm listening to this man read through the Book of Mormon, and then things like Alma Jr. comes along, and there's this big battle with the Nephites, I think it is.
I'm not sure which.
I don't know. I'm sorry. There's a lot of battles. Like, every other week, there was a battle. And I'm like, this is incredibly violent. Like, are they teaching this to children? Because this is, whoa. So there's this section, well, like, because I'm not reading this from a theological perspective. I'm reading it as like, well, this is something that I should learn, because Mormonism is an American, like, religion, and that Mormon history is American history, and that should be important to us, right?
Well, and also, you don't live in Utah, right? So
not
somebody who's surrounded by Mormons, and, like, it affects the culture that you live in. You live in...
Yeah, so like, I think I'd met a Mormon once. Maybe.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, it was just the wacky Utah religion to you before the Book of Mormon came along.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, because I wanted to know. And then all of a sudden, I'm hearing this story about how there's a big battle of like 15,000 people die on one side and 20,000 die on the other side. And so Alma directs his troops to grab the dead bodies and throw them in the river to create a bridge. And then his group of warriors like march across the bridge of dead bodies and then have another battle of like 20,000 people die. And then in the very next chapter, he gives a sermon about how great Jesus Christ is. And then they drink the water from the river downstream. And I'm like, what? Is this
one of those overlooked details?
Yeah, this little thing. So I'm listening to this, and then David Michael got a promotion at work, and he put a little thing up. He's like, I don't have time to do this show anymore. I was like, my favorite podcast is going to go away. No. And so I sent an email to Bryce, who was at that time, he was reading The Doctrine and Covenants.
Well, back up a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry, back up.
David went through the Book of Mormon and the Pearl of Great Price, and like, those are fun. You can read them alone, stand alone, and learn a lot about Mormon theology and doctrine. But the Doctrine and Covenants, if you don't know anything about Mormon history and you're just reading it cover to cover, it can be very dry. It's not it can be. It just is. It's boring if you're not reading it with the historical context. And I had started my Mormon history podcast, Naked Mormonism, a year and a half prior, before he got to the Doctrine and Covenants, and he invited me to become a co-host where I would teach him the history of the church as we read through the Doctrine and Covenants. And then we got into, section 16, 17, something like that, really early on.
Like maybe section 20. Okay. Yeah, maybe. I should remember this, and I don't. So David, he left the show, and he graciously gave it to me. So now Bryce and I have been reading it. And so this is where things get really interesting, because I thought that everybody knew everything about every aspect of Mormon history, because I assumed that when you're in primary school, you're learning the dates and you're learning the times and you're learning the names of your every historical figure along the way, right?
But it's religion, not history.
I thought it was history.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's one thing that I do often take issue with within the church and how the Doctrine and Covenants is taught, is because it's largely cherry-picked, and reading the sections and specific verses out of sections, not even reading the entire sections, and just saying, look how great it is. The Lord is saying, the field is wide, all ready to harvest. Thrust with your sickle with all your might. You see these passages, and you understand the divine genesis of these, and it's beautiful. It's a beautiful passage, and it gives you the burning in your bosom. But when you understand the historical context of the church during New York, its early stint in New York was near dying. It hadn't reached the critical mass where it was self-sustaining, so Joseph decided to lift this passage out of the Bible and, you know, commission a divine sales force and send them out to preach to the Native Americans. If you don't read it with the historical context, you lose so much.
And this is where, having never been raised or known any of this, I read that field ready to harvest, and I was like, what crop are we harvesting? Like, I had no idea. It was the concept that people are the crop that you're supposed to bring into the church. And I was like, oh.
So I want to field a couple questions to you, because I think this is kind of unique, because most people who are not, who didn't grow up Mormon, or who are not studying Mormon history with the intent to teach it or to, you know, get a degree in religious history or whatever, most outsiders never read the book the Doctrine and Covenants.
Yeah, that's what I've learned. Like, I've learned that a lot of people have read various sections of it as part of something else, but very few have read every single one in chronological order.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've been told that I'm doing it wrong, because I need to have my bishop tell me how to interpret these things correctly. And I'm like, where do I find a bishop? Who is a bishop?
Because, back to basics.
Back to basics, yeah. Because the basics of what I consider to be modern day Mormonism, which in my world is everything after 1844.
Oh, hang on. Qualifier. Anyone not listening, we had a strict no spoilers rule.
Oh, yeah, about that, yeah.
So as we're reading through the Doctrine and Covenants and reading it as chronologically as we could, I was teaching her the history as the revelations are happening, which is a very weird way to learn Mormon history.
I assumed this was the only way to learn Mormon history. All right, let me talk about like the first really big thing that I blew it on. Just, I missed it entirely. All right, so you all know this. So it's like 1830, things aren't super great in New York. So in the middle of winter, oh my God, and Emma is like 5 months pregnant. Let's talk about this. And they go over to this place called Kirtland, which I think I was calling it Kirkland for a while because that's a brand of diapers from Costco. You know, so I'm like, oops. So that's not the big one that I messed up. That's just the little one. And at the time, I was calling it Doctrines and Covenants. And I got a very nice email from a listener who's like, Doctrine and Covenants. I'm like, oh, yeah, sorry. All right, so they're middle of winter. They go to Ohio. And Joseph, in his revelations, because like I'm reading this as we go through, he's using the word Zion. And he's also using the word Kirtland. And so I read them in like sentences right next to each other, 100% thought that Zion was Kirtland, Ohio. Absolutely. Like so much so that we're reading through some other thing like the next week. I'm like, well, Bryce, but the Promised Land, it's in Kirtland because it says this. And he's like, what? No. So I had to look it up. I'm like, it's like, no, it doesn't actually say Zion is Kirtland. It's just heavily implied.
Yeah. It's kind of hard to tease out when it was happening, right? We have to put ourselves in the mentality of these restorationists, these Zionists that were at the foundation of Mormonism. And it seems as if they declared Zion was Independence, Missouri. Prior to that, though, Zion was just wherever you made it. And now, since the Mormons were kicked out of Jackson County, Zion has now just become this ethereal concept where Zion just lives in your heart. It's not a literal, specific gathering place, as the scriptures tell us that it's a literal gathering. It's more of just whatever you make of the world, whatever is the perfect place for you, that is your Zion. And that's the more common modern interpretation of Zion. But the original 1830 interpretation of Zion, the specific language, when you're reading through the specific language of that revelation, it's really hard to not read Kirtland is Zion.
Mm-hmm. And then a couple revelations later, it actually does say Kirtland in the same sentence as Zion, but at that point, Missouri had already, some of them moved to Missouri. So depending on how you interpret it with your modern day looking back, hindsight is 20/20, yes, you can absolutely say, well, clearly it's saying that Zion is in Independence, Missouri, in that field on the other side of where the judge's courthouse is. Obviously, which I now is like, what's that, the Temple Lot Mormons?
Temple Lot Mormons.
Yeah, like you can see that now, modern day. But as I was reading it through, that revelation that everybody who grew up in the church, I'm assuming, thinks that it's in Independence, Missouri still, the only town that's mentioned in this revelation is Kirtland. So it's like, who's right here? Was it me not knowing this context, reading through this thing that only says Kirtland, but actually it's not because it's in Independence? And that's when I started getting very confused. And when I was like, Bryce, I'm so glad you actually know this history, because I don't.
And the thing is, too, the Doctrine and Covenants, the timeline with the revelations are really weird, right? And most of the dates have been added at later times. Mm-hmm. But when we start out in 1830, the revelations are coming fast.
It's like every couple days. We'd be talking about things like, okay, so 2 weeks ago we learned that blah, blah, blah. And then yesterday we learned blah, blah, blah. And today we're learning through this next revelation, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and there was very little historical context to fill in between each of the revelations. But as we get in the later Kirtland years, the chasm between revelations continues to grow. So it goes from a revelation every couple weeks, or you know, three revelations in 2 days, to having a span of multiple months between revelations. And a lot of history happens then.
Yeah. Things like Fanny Alger. That happens. I mean, Fanny Alger, her name isn't in the revelations. I don't think, no.
No,
she's not.
There's
right?
only one okay. revelation to a woman.
Oh, that's right. That's Emma Smith. Like, hey, shut your mouth, Emma. Stop complaining about us chewing tobacco and having it drip on your head in the kitchen. I'm paraphrasing. I'm totally paraphrasing.
But I think it is important that, like, as we continue to progress, originally what it set out, the original format when you first came on was just reading through the Doctrine and Covenants and kind of obliquely talking about the history as it was happening, tracking the timeline of the Mormon exodus from New York into Kirtland and out to Missouri, and just kind of meandering through these. But then we get to these revelations where, we jump, 3 months where we just jump into the Fishing River revelation at the end of Zion's camp. And suddenly I'm like, all right, Marie, sit down, because we're going to spend a lot of time talking about Zion's camp.
Yeah.
And all of the historical context of just what happened in Missouri that led to Zion's camp. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of time in order to put that information and that revelation specifically into context.
And this is where I think the focus of our reading and the show itself fundamentally started to change. Because it started as I'm just kind of learning about Mormonism through the lens of these revelations from God through his prophet Joseph Smith, except occasionally Sidney Rigdon is there. So, okay. And then all of a sudden, because of these gaps, Bryce became so fundamentally important. I mean, you've always been important to me. Anytime, man. But he said, okay, we're going to learn about Zion's camp. And I'm like, what's Zion's camp? Because I'd never heard of it. And so I was thinking a bunch of people went to Missouri, and because they had just moved there, like, they brought their camping gear. So they set up, and then everybody just stayed in Missouri, and everybody was happy. Okay, about that.
But it... Because the timeline of Mormonism begins to become so chaotic once we hit 1835. It seems like Zion's Camp was a shift where things become more focused on the church as an organization as opposed to the church as a religion. And what I mean by that is we get, after the return of Zion's Camp, we get the organization of the middle management. We get the Quorum of the 70s and the Quorum of Apostles that are organized, and we get into the final phases of building the temple, you know, the first big construction project that all the Mormons had banded together and funneled their resources into. And then we get into the Kirtland Safety Society in order to answer so many debts. And there's so many things that happen so quickly. And the timeline of when the revelations are given continues to expand further and further and further, to the point that we get a revelation in, what is it, I think the end of 1837, mm-hmm. and then all of Missouri is just gone, and then we're reading the letters from Liberty Jail.
Yeah, that was a really big shift, because, again, I didn't know any of this history, because you all knew what the word depredations meant. Man, I had to struggle to pronounce that thing.
And like, Hans Mill.
Hans Mill.
And
I spelled it wrong.
The Crooked River and all of it. Yeah.
I knew all of these theological concepts from the early church. But this is the early church before they had a temple. So ordinances, which I've learned how to say that word correctly, those didn't really exist. And the word bishopric didn't exist. So if I'd ever hear something in the news, or a current Mormon would email me and say, hey, about this thing, here's a thought that you should know about it. And I'm like, I don't understand. What is a relief society? Because it's not written down.
Yeah.
So I I miss it. And so I could pass as somebody who knew the basics of Mormon anything. But as soon as I started going beyond, at this point, 1837, I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah,
it was very awkward. Continues to be awkward.
Well, and it took us, two full episodes of not reading any revelations to go through the Missouri Mormon War, because it's so complex.
Yeah, right? I learned who this guy named Little Burn Boggs was. That was cool.
Yeah.
Apparently he's
others.
Really important. Yeah,
yeah. And General Lucas. And there's so many prominent figures throughout it. And then we jump into these Liberty Jail letters. And after that, there's another massive gap when we get into DNC 124. And this was complex enough that we had to invite on a couple of historians, because my studies of Nauvoo history are still in such infantile stages right now. I still barely grasp what was going on in Nauvoo. And I think that anybody who claims that they truly know everything about Nauvoo is just lying, because it's so wildly complex. And Mormonism is so vast. It's encapsulating more than 10,000 people in the Nauvoo years. And there's so many projects that are happening, and there's so many prominent figures there's always the politics and backbiting that was going on within the church hierarchy. And it's so much more complex. So once we get into DNC 124, which was the first revelation given in Nauvoo, we had to invite on Joe Geisner and Cheryl Bruno to tell us what is going on. Cheryl, wave from the back. Thank you so much, Cheryl. Looking forward to your Masonic book. Book on Masonry. There's a difference. Sorry. But we have to invite on people who are much more familiar with the time than I am, because I still don't grasp even the most basic concepts of Nauvoo history. And people have been very gracious in helping us get through these. And then, of course, we got to 132.
Oh, the revelation on polygamy. That was amazing. Because I knew that there was something to do with polygamy and Mormonism, because when I was little, I heard the word Mormonism once, so I went to my mom, the Baptist pastor's wife, and I was like, "Mom, what's Mormonism?" And she went, "I think it's like Christianity, but wrong." And now as a mother, I'm like, man, I wouldn't know how to answer that. Like, if somebody came up to me and said, "Mom, what's Buddhism?" I'd be like, I don't know. Yeah. And sorry, where was I? I got distracted by
polygamy.
Polygamy. Yes.
Did she tell you about
that? She did say that there was something to do with multiple wives and that that was bad. And I was like, well, that sounds like a bad idea, because that's logistically very complicated. And like, I know how to fill out forms for whatever. And you put out your two parents. I'm like, there's not enough forms for, like, how would this even work?
Legal forms.
Legal forms.
No.
Yeah. And so I assumed that everyone in Mormonism for the entirety of the early religion was like always doing polygamy, always, like from the beginning. But then it turns out it wasn't, that it was Joseph, that he'd been, depending on how you read it, sometimes he received like Revelation 132 on polygamy back in like 1831, but he didn't tell anybody about it. I was like, head tilt, what is even happening here?
Yeah, and it's so complex, because initially 132, the way it reads, is it wasn't meant to be a public declaration.
And that blew my mind. Like, yeah. Why would, if you were communicating directly with God, God was giving you words and had told you to start the correct religion, like restored the priesthood, which also I know that phrase, that if you were, had God tell you something so fundamentally important that it would change the social structure of the entire world, why would you keep that a secret?
That's an interesting question, right?
It's always an interesting question. Everything about Mormonism is an interesting question.
And why would it be? Why would it take from 1831, when there are the first whisperings? You know, as there's no written revelation of it, but merely people asking Joseph, "How are we to take the Lamanites to wives the way that the prophets of the Bible did?" That's, we don't have any written down version of that revelation. And there's only further musings of people having conversations with Joseph and are asking him directly, what is, you know, what's going on with polygamy. And then we finally get to 132 in Nauvoo, when things are so very chaotic, and the spans between each revelation in Nauvoo, there's so few. In Nauvoo, 124 is the first one that's given, and then 135 is the last of Joseph's revelations, whereas the previous 110 were given in Kirtland era?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's baffling to know that Mormonism got so much bigger, and then in the Nauvoo years, there's so much more that happens, but so fewer revelations to read from. And then 132 reading like it was meant to be directed to Emma Smith only, not to be a public decree that was given. It just makes it more complicated. It makes it a very confusing deal, and it makes us wonder what conversations were being had behind closed doors that historians will never know. That no matter how far we dig, that the only references that we might know from these behind-closed-door conversations are what people remembered and recounted at a later time. We don't have audio recordings of what Joseph Smith was telling, or when Brigham Young taught the revelation of polygamy to Hiram Smith. We don't have an audio recording of that. We just have Brigham Young telling us about it at a later date. They were sitting on a fence. I mean, there's... there's so much complexity to DNC 132 alone, but I feel like the way that we did it was really fun.
It was an interesting way to see how we had to shift how we learned about these particular revelations as we're reading them, by necessity had to change over time, because the issue of what's left in and what's left out, like during these gaps, and even when we are having revelations all the time, it's that what's your source text? If you're reading from beginning to end all these revelations from God, I assumed that I could pick up a copy of the Doctrine and Covenants at my local ward, which I didn't. I accidentally drunk ordered one off of Amazon. I'm so sorry, everybody. Whoops. That was a very surprising notification to get. that I assumed that this was going to be the same. That while there might be different printings of it, that the words would be exactly the same from the very first one in 1833. And then I assumed as time goes on, they would be adding more, like when 1835 and the 1844 version. And so then when I looked at the 2013, it would still be exactly the same going all the way back.
Yeah.
About that. Yeah. I invite everybody, after this is all done, go to comparednc.com. Comparednc.com. And you can look at, I don't know if it's all, but most of the versions of the Doctrine and Covenants throughout time. And you can pull up any of the versions on the left side, any of the versions on the right side, and it will highlight the differences.
It is fun to see, right? So a listener of the show actually built this website just for us, mm-hmm. for us to be able to read and compare the earliest printed version of the Revelations, which is what I'm reading, because I'm all about the church history. I want to read the original printed version. And then Marie was reading the most recent version, the 2013 mm-hmm. version. Later on, you found out that the Community of Christ have their own proprietary version.
Did you know the Community of Christ exists? That blew my mind.
We've been very careful about no spoilers, and that has led to some very confusing questions. Wait, there's a Community of Christ? They're Mormon?
Yeah, no.
But
surely they're exactly the same in all ways, right?
But needless to say, the differences in the earliest revelations of the 1830 revelations compared to the revised, even the from the 1833 printing to the 1835 printing of those revelations from 1830, the differences are profound and vast and very numerous. So just reading through what the revelation initially said, and then reading through the 2013 version, and to see entire paragraphs that were added or deleted from the revelation, it poses an interesting question.
Why would they do that?
These are claimed to be divine words channeled through the mouthpiece of God. But at a later time, an editor had to come along and add or delete entire paragraphs, entire passages, or move them around to a different location. Why does that need to happen? Does that therefore not logically follow that God made a mistake? It's hard to wrestle with. I can't understand this. And the same question exists with the Book of Mormon, with, you know, edits that have been made to the Book of Mormon as well, because this is, well, you know, this is the divine revelation from God. And we can say if there was taken from gold plates, well, there were translation errors, you know, translating it to English. But Joseph wasn't using the gold plates. He was using a rock and a hat. So the mistakes in the Book of Mormon imply that God messed up.
So,
how do we square that?
So what I did, I went to the source of truth. I went to LDS.org. And I typed in the question, why are there changes in the Doctrine and Covenants? Because as we were comparing the different versions, we realized that the number one change is in the chapter headings. And if you look in the original versions, like 1833, 1835, it will give a date. Sometimes it'll give a place, occasionally. But if you look at the 2013, it's usually a pretty extensive description of some aspect of the history at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It and doesn't tell you all of the historical context
no.
by any stretch of imagination.
No, but it's like
but it
some.
Just, it's like, it's a paragraph to summarize, like, what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
And it helps.
Which is very helpful. Like, A plus, thank you to the people who wrote those. But it said on LDS.org that it didn't mention the changes within the actual revelations themselves. That's just, like, not mentioned. So if you didn't know there were changes, you wouldn't even think to ask. So I see that as an issue that should be addressed. And it just said, changes have been made to the chapter headings for historical context in 2016. That's what it said on LDS.org. Want to talk about what it says today? Let me read it to you. And this is, if you go to LDS.org, I'm assuming today, this is what it'll say. Since the 1981 edition of the Doctrine and Covenants, historical research, much of it conducted by those working on the Joseph Smith papers, has led to new information on many sections of the Doctrine and Covenants. Adjustments have been made to correct inaccurate facts, to provide more precise dating of many sections, and in some cases, to supply historical context that better aids in the understanding of the sections. So that is a good thing for them to say, but Joseph Smith papers wasn't mentioned anywhere when we first looked, like on the entire page of LDS.org, because Joseph Smith papers did exist at the time. So I looked because I was like, are these even related websites? I don't even know. I didn't know anything. But it just wasn't mentioned. And now it's like right there. But there's no mention that this has just been added in the last 2 years. So what else has changed on LDS.org that we don't know about?
And it doesn't chronicle that there have been those changes.
Mm-hmm.
And it still feels like it doesn't say section headings in here.
No.
It feels like it's still just referring to the section headings. It doesn't talk about changes in the doctrines and revelations themselves, in the actual text of the divine words of God channeled through Joseph Smith. It still has yet to provide an answer for why that would be necessary. Now, to clarify this, a lot of those edits were made from the 1833 Book of Commandments to the 1835 edition. A lot of those edits were made by Joseph Smith or by his scribes or the compilers of the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants. But there are changes that have happened in the 1844 that Joseph Smith probably oversaw as well that are, you know, that alter the words of even the 1835 edition. There are changes in the 2013 version that Joseph Smith was never a part of. And I get it. So if we're editing the words of God, if Joseph himself is the one who gave the initial words and he's also the one editing it, that feels excusable. But if we're talking about the words of God and an editor at a later time coming along like B.H. Roberts and changing those words, I feel like that poses an issue because we believe in the church that new revelation trumps old revelation. But that's not the same as changing old revelations. It would be, it's a matter of you would need to come out with a new revelation to clarify a previous revelation or a new revelation to strike out an old revelation. But that's not what has happened in the Brighamite tradition. Community of Christ, yes.
Yes.
But Brighamite tradition holds to this weird, we can change the words that we want when it best suits us. And we're never going to tell you about that. And that is a problem with transparency. And that does, I feel like that poses some serious issues that require consideration. These are the divine words of God. And editors are telling us what God says.
I adore Community of Christ because of their transparency. So I learned the existence at all of Community of Christ last year at Sunstone when a listener came up to me and he grabbed my hand and said, you need to meet my friends. And he took me to the Community of Christ booth. And they were amazing, you guys. They let me just like gush about Mormon history and they were very kind. And then they handed me their version of the Doctrine and Covenants, which is similar in a lot of ways, but obviously very different because they have revelations from 1860 going on. And so I started reading, Bryce would be reading the Brighamite D&C, and I would be reading from Community of Christ, which would be mostly the same, but like for my chapter headings from the Community of Christ version, it would give you footnotes of like where to look. So they would say, we have changed this because of blah, blah, blah reason, and you can see the documentation for it from this manuscript, which is located in this location, and check the appendix for more information. You'd go to the appendix, and they have these chronological charts by year of all of the editions that they've published, and then it lists everything that has changed. Everything that has changed over time. So if you want to see, oh, did something change? Yes, it has. Here's exactly where it has changed. Here's where I go if I want to know why. And that transparency is beautiful.
Yes. It's information. Do with information what you will, but give me the information. Don't hide it. It's honest to be transparent. The inverse of that is true as well. If you are hiding information like that, that is not honest. That is dishonest. And people wonder why when they come to know the history of the church and they feel like they have been lied to about the history of the church, and then they pose questions to Mormon historians or to a CES director or whatever the case may be, that provide these questions of historical inconsistencies or problems, the question or the answer is always thrown out. Well, the information is there, you just had to go find it. But that is different than having the information available. There's a difference between that and teaching that information. Because largely we are going to consume what information we are handed. Now, the internet has allowed us to democratize where that information comes from and what kinds of information we get. But prior to that, we were only able to understand the information that we were spoon-fed. And in the church, we are spoon-fed a very, very sanitized and pleasant version and an incredibly incomplete version of Mormon history. And the transparency is the issue here, because if you're not being transparent about historical issues, then that is tantamount to lying. That is lie through omission. And that is a problem. And I think that serves to be the catalyst for a lot of ex-Mormons and post-Mormons being angry when they leave the church, especially if they go through and read the Doctrine and Covenants with a Wikipedia page open. Who is this person? Why did Frederick G. Williams get a revelation to, you know, to consecrate his property to the church? Turns out that they built the Kirtland Temple on his property. Why did William Law get a revelation to be called to the second counselor of the church and then later be one of the publishers of the Nauvoo Expositor, right? When you read the Wikipedia pages or the Joseph Smith biography pages, you know, much more trustworthy sources that we would consider, if we read those sources along with the Doctrine and Covenants, we get a more holistic picture. But that was never the picture that we're sold in the church. We're never taught that.
And the picture that I see, because no one spoon-fed me anything other than Baptist doctrine, is that I don't know why Brigham Young is important. Who is this guy? He's mentioned once. Clearly he's not important, because if he was, he would have been in the Doctrine and Covenants more. Am I right? Oops. Because I just was reading this through chronologically, trying not to find out what happened next. So if I did open up a Wikipedia page on any of these bajillion white men who are mentioned, I would stop as soon as I like hit the bit in time where we are. And so I was learning about these men that are getting sent out on missions, and I'd look up like, oh, this person, they immigrated from England, and this one, he worked on the Erie Canal, and this person, like, they're from New York. And it's like, all these just like historical characters that just come to life for me. But I think that obviously the most important person is Sidney Rigdon, because he's mentioned all the time. And like the revelations say that if Joseph dies, Sidney Rigdon should be the next person.
Oh, those were council minutes.
Those were council minutes, right. The chapter heading said that was council minutes, but it was still there. It was like, it's a revelation from God, but it's not. Because the chapter heading said as it is, and I was like, I don't understand. So, like, I'm learning all these people and these characters that I assume...
And falling in love with one of them.
Oliver Cowdery. Oh, my God, you guys. I just can't. Oh, yeah. So, like, Oliver Cowdery is clearly the most important person more than Joseph Smith. We all just... Let's just agree on that. That I assumed, well, Oliver Cowdery, because he was the scribe. He was the guy who was there. Like, have you seen the promotional videos about the early days of the church? That guy is hot. And so, obviously, Oliver Cowdery is going to stay there the entire time. And obviously, no one liked Martin Harris, because he just gave all his money to the church, but then bankrupted himself and beat his wife. And nobody likes a wife beater. Oh, okay. Apparently, he's really important. And he came back to the church? Like, this is a thing, but like, because I'm only reading this and looking at the people who are mentioned, Brigham Young doesn't exist. And I wouldn't even know enough to care about him, except that there's a thing called BYU. And Bryce, and as we're going through the historical context of things, Bryce will say, oh, here's this major event, and Brigham Young got everybody in Missouri to Illinois while Joseph Smith is sitting in a jail. Right. Oh, he's important.
And to clarify that, like, a lot of that is attributed, you know, Uncle John Smith was kind of one of the main guys who was working to organize the exodus from Missouri to Illinois, but Brigham Young and the remaining apostles who were not arrested at the time, they were the boots on the ground. They were the middle managers that handled most of the logistics for it. And that, I feel like, is the turning point where Brigham Young really starts to come into his own, or begins to create his place within the leadership of the church, which is really important to understand. As, you know, last night we just did the death of Joseph Smith. The next revelation we're reading is D&C 135. And very soon after that, we have to go through a lot of history of the schism crisis. I call it a schism grenade because it's not like it was just a smooth transition. Oh, now it's Brigham Young and all the Mormons just decided on a lark to move to Utah because why not? Mexico, sorry.
That's what I thought it was. And I'm hearing all these rumblings from everybody who knows what happens. They're like, oh, it was not easy. No. It was not pleasant. It was not clean. It's just a big mess.
Yeah. And like, you've attended a few historical presentations, so you violated the spoiler rule. The sanctity has been destroyed.
I blame Lindsay Hanson Park.
But I mean, altogether, like, there's still so much more that has to happen because Mormonism isn't over with Joseph Smith. It just gets started.
And we are about to finish the Brighamite D&C. And we're planning to keep moving on and reading more revelations because apparently Brigham Young had some. Let's read those. There's a guy named Strang. Apparently he existed. So let's read some of his works. I have the hard copy of the Community of Christ D&C. Let's read that. Let's learn about the history of the people who stayed in Nauvoo. And then at the same time, like, what are Brigham and everybody in Salt Lake City, what are they doing in 1862? Not the Civil War. Okay. So we're going to keep on reading because this is fascinating stuff. And this is history. This is your history. This is my history. I have no idea where my ancestors come from. And I'm sure many of you are from good pioneer stock, which is another phrase that I've learned. And so we're going to keep learning.
I want to ask a couple questions. What was your favorite part of Doctrine and Covenants?
I love this one. Okay, so James Covell in D&C 39, this is January 5th, 1831. This is one of those like bajillion revelations where Joseph says to some white guy, gather up your stuff and go get me more followers and their money. Okay, great. And so then I flip the page to D&C 40, and I'm very surprised that the very next day, this revelation is saying that the devil tempted away James Covell, and he just nopes right the hell out of there. I was like, really? They kept this in here? They could have edited anything else, but instead they have this blatant thing that apparently Satan is way more powerful than the prophet of Joseph Smith and God. To just take this guy who's been revelated, like, you are going to go do amazing things. And he's like, no, I'm not. And he just leaves. Love it. What was your favorite?
Did we ever talk about Jesse Gauss very much?
Oh, very briefly. I can't remember.
Because the initial revelation calling Sidney Rigdon and Frederick G. Williams to the presidency of the church, it was initially Jesse Gauss.
They just erased him from history.
Yeah, it's just and strike replaced through. His name. Oh, yep. Carrot. Frederick G. Williams.
Yeah. Oops. All right, we meant. Good. Yeah. Yeah. Oops. We meant Freddie G. Like, what, yeah. Really? Okay.
So I don't know. I guess my favorite part is this was a piece of my Mormon upbringing of reading through segments of the Doctrine and Covenants. I never read through it cover to cover. I was not what somebody would consider a stalwart Mormon. I was very center of the road. Like I was not too occupied with learning the church while I was a member of it. And knowing the history and learning the history as we progress through and learning the depths of Mormon history as we read through the Doctrine and Covenants and using the Doctrine and Covenants as a framework to pattern what we are learning and what we are talking about on the show and also for my show, I feel like I have a much more holistic appreciation of the Doctrine and Covenants. I feel like I understand it and I can empathize with the need for those revelations being given when they were initially given within the context of the world of Mormonism when they were given. And that is a version of the Doctrine and Covenants that I never would have learned while I was in the church. I mean, these are only thought experiments. Maybe as a member, after I took out my endowments, I'd have a spiritual manifestation and I would be an active stalwart member today and as well as a history, a lover of Mormon history. But I don't know. I never really had that. I had a burning in the bosom, but I never had a truly transcendent spiritual experience. So I was able to read these revelations outside of the church while being an insider, while having the insider knowledge, while being brought up in the culture, while being born in the covenant, but see it from a very naturalistic lens. And when you view these revelations as Joseph and friends needed a thing done, they gave a revelation and the thing got done, it makes a lot more sense. If we go on to postulate that there is divine genesis and a divine hand within all of this, the milieu of these revelations being given, that feels like it only posits more questions than it ever answers. So I feel like what I enjoyed most about this was gaining a naturalistic appreciation for the Doctrine and Covenants and knowing where they came from.
I love reading the Doctrine and Covenants. This has been a really, really good experience. And I saw that wince over there from the crowd. You're like, really? You like this? Yes. Yes, I've loved learning, and we're going to keep learning. And so our time is almost up, and we want to have time for Q&A. But if you want to read along with us, it's My Book of Mormon Podcast. You can find it wherever podcasts are found. You can also go to mybookofmormonpodcast.com, listen directly on our website. Bryce, please tell us about your podcast, because it is amazing.
Yeah, I do what I call the Serial Mormon History Podcast, Naked Mormonism. I just start with episode 1 with the birth of Joseph Smith. Had I done it all again, I would have started at the Enlightenment period, because you drop a pin on understanding who Joseph Smith is. If you drop it at his birth, you have no idea what kind of world Joseph Smith grew up in. So, and I just progressed chronologically from there, and I'm really wrestling with Nauvoo right now. It's wildly complex, but also extremely invigorating and exciting and fun. It's fun. Mormon history is really, really fun.
It's the best.
And here we are at Sunstone for that very reason.
Which is the best.
So thank you all for coming, and
thank
I guess
you.
We got Q&A.
Okay, looks like we have about 10 minutes for questions, so if you have any, feel free to come up to the mic. I'll start off. Question for Marie. Did you find anything theologically enlightening in the DNC, or did it just kind of alternate between weird and boring?
You mean weird and interesting? I loved watching the evolution of Mormon theology, because the concept of, when you die, if you're a man, then you get your own planet, did not exist when you start. And the things changed very, very subtly over time. And it went from this thing that I didn't recognize to, I'm like, oh, yeah, that sounds like Mormonism. Like when you're establishing a hierarchy of the church, you're also establishing the fact that the priesthood authority exists and how that shapes your life. And that concept blew my mind, and I loved seeing that evolution.
So what's next? Are you moving on to Pearl of Great Price? Are you going to move on to, conference talks? Or are you just going to kind of wrap it up at
weekly
where
episode on the enzyme?
Yeah.
No.
Seriously.
No, so David Michael, who I mentioned at the beginning, he read through the Pearl of Great Price. And so he called it the Pricey Pearl on there. So if you read it, so that is there as along with the Book of Abraham. So we're not going to do that. We're going to read I always mess this up. Lectures on faith? Articles on faith. Lectures on faith. I'm so sorry.
We'll help you out.
Yeah. So that's going to be our immediate thing. And after that, what are we doing?
We're kind of wrestling with it, because we could go
Not to a Journal of Discourses. Don't tempt me.
Joseph Fielding Smith. No. Is that answers to gospel questions. That would be a good one.
No. Okay.
We
want to keep this historical. We want to stick with Mormon history and the initial prophets of Mormonism. And Mormonism is so much more than Brighamism. And I think that it's probably a good idea after, because there's only a couple of Brighamite revelations left. After we finish Brighamite, I feel like we should just progress chronologically, which I think would lead us to Strangism. Because that's prior to the reorganization, prior to the RLDS and their revelations. And Strangism was a very short stint. But they had a charismatic prophet, seer, and revelator that gave his own revelations and his own translations. And if we're going to appreciate Mormon history, we shouldn't just appreciate Brighamite history. We should understand and come to fall in love with all Mormon history. So that's my best bet. We still have a lot of talking to do about that.
Yeah, if you have an idea and you're not able to get up here to tell us, like, grab us afterwards. But also, you can email me comments@mybookofmormonpodcast.com with your ideas.
My favorite moment with Marie and Bryce was when I mentioned off the top of my head something about Jesus being born on April 6th, and she was like, "Wait, stop!"
I had no idea.
And
it
I was
so
like,
cute.
"Well, you've already gone through that section of Doctrine and Covenants. You should already know that."
Well, Bryce didn't tell me, so I missed it entirely.
I missed a lot too.
We go back, and you know, you look at the verse, and it doesn't exactly say that Jesus was born on April 6th.
This is why we always need you, Cheryl. Always.
But I'm thinking there's lots of Mormon doctrine that we have that we kind of, it's folklore coming from maybe a certain verse that we have interpreted a certain way. And if you're not Mormon, yes. You just...
Oh, I just missed it.
Yeah, it goes right over your head. You don't, you know, take that as Jesus was born on April 6th. So are there any other experiences you've had with that kind of thing where you just were blown away by something?
I'm going to kick it to Bryce. Is there anything that you've just assumed that I knew that I just didn't?
I feel like that happens on the micro level almost every episode.
Well,
because to be honest, like, we did it with the no spoilers, and there's big events that come up that I'm like, oh, next revelation is going to be really fun. By the way, Marie, next revelation, if you click over to it, it's like, you know, 12 verses. It's going to take us 3 episodes to get through it, just to let
cha-ching.
You know. Right? So, like I've known the big events that come up, but there's these teeny little mannerisms and Mormonese, we call it, right? It's our own jargon that we share as a collective culture. And all the time I say words that are Mormonese, and Marie's like, what?
Bishopric?
Bishopric.
I stumbled over that word so hard.
Yeah, it just happens all the time. So.
Yeah. Oh, remember that time when, because I'd never actually seen Hill Gomorrah written down, I thought it was Hill Gomorrah, like Sodom and Gomorrah. I'd been saying that wrong for like 2 years.
Yes, well, when you had mentioned that gaffe earlier where someone said doctrines and covenants, it reminded me of another gaffe where many people have said the covenants and doctrine.
But, I used to say that, too, and I was trying to remember what was the phrasing of this book that I'm reading? I don't know.
Anyway, my question is, have either of you noticed or been fascinated by the fact that with the LDS DNC, that they've actually closed the canon of Scripture at Declaration 2, whereas the Community of Christ, the DNC, has an open canon?
Very fascinated by that. Well, and then I think that speaks to something that we were talking about a little bit earlier, was like, the Community of Christ embraces that they have a living Scripture and that new revelation trumps old revelation. That's the way that it's sold, or that we're taught is how it works in Brighamism, but we haven't had a new revelation since 1978, and before that it was 1890, and that wasn't really a real revelation. It was just a declaration.
If you didn't hear that, he just meant, well, the November policy. But you'll notice that's a policy.
It's a policy.
It's not a revelation.
But it's not canonized.
But it's not canonized.
It's not canonized.
Yeah, so that's
right?
Like, if it's not canonized, how would I as an outsider ever know? I would never know that. So if this is, if it is a revelation from the God, from God.
From the gods?
From the gods, that the president, the prophet of your religion, which should change how you live your life, because if this is the way you get to God, you know, like, this is a big deal. How come only you get to know about it? Why wouldn't I get to know about it? If this is the one true, correct religion, how come I can't pick it up and just read it? I have to go to a website and know? Excuse me, not everybody has internet access. Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, in agreement to your question, yeah, like, maybe the Brighamite Church should embrace the whole idea of living books of Revelation and change, right? Like, throughout the 70s and 80s and 90s, when the RLDS was going through this growing pain phase that eventually culminated into them rebranding into the Community of Christ and streamlining, that hurt. That hurt their membership numbers, their income numbers. That really hurt. And all that information is transparent and open because the Community of Christ is open with their numbers. It's wonderful.
Love it.
But the Brighamite Church doesn't do that, right? They haven't embraced this idea that, oh, we can go through a new Mormon Reformation period with less killing and recanonize and write out the racist parts of our revelations and become more inclusive and equal and become more like the Community of Christ. And I actually am very, I love the Community of Christ much like you, because they embrace that idea of, like, we should follow the religion that best suits us and best helps us deal with the world around us. Brighamism is very
exclusionary.
Yeah, very iron-fisted, very demanding, very straight-laced. And it doesn't comport well with the world around us. It isn't fluid enough to adapt, and that will be a that's a crack in the foundation of the church.
Yeah, this isn't my question, but picking up on what you just said, I would call it a silo.
Silo.
Yeah.
Like an information silo?
Yes.
Ah, yes.
I mean, there are, but my question actually is, Joseph's life was filled with crises, and only the one in Nauvoo was only the latest one. And one of the things that contributed to that was a substantial number of people among his followers who were beginning to question whether it's sound to base the fate of an entire community upon the revelations of one charismatic individual. I don't know much about that, but can you fill in a little bit?
I will do my best, but I think there was a marked shift in Missouri, because in Kirtland, it was largely a cohesive body, but as it progressed into 1835 and 36, that's when Joseph started making enemies from within the church. They began questioning, and he had to watch his back a lot more. Missouri comes along. The Mormons are in a complete state of crisis. And, you know, the Danites were proven to exist because of dissenters who had fallen away. Dr. Samson Avard and Thomas B. Marsh went and signed their affidavits that allowed the government to understand that the Mormons had their own rogue militia force. Then we get to Nauvoo, and that problem only seems to significantly worsen, where the locus of control is no longer in Joseph's charismatic, exciting, revelatory period. It is the ability of the people around him to control the Mormons as a cohesive body. And as Joseph continues to be a wacky, charismatic guy and doing whatever he wants, those fractures that happen within the church that were initially created in Kirtland with dissension that was happening there, they start to become foundation-breaking issues. And I think that speaks to why the schism crisis was so vitriolic and so divided, because the Mormons themselves were symptomatic of how incohesive the body truly was. And that was, the leadership itself was just a microcosm of that. You know, William Law was second counselor, and he published the Nauvoo Expositor, right? And the thing that led to Joseph Smith's death was published from within the highest ranking body of the church. That shows that there's a profound problem. And this does speak also to the how unsustainable charismatic leading is, right? So if you're a Brighamite, a Brigham Young, He's very by the books. You follow the rules. But Joseph Smith leads by charisma. But that's not sustainable because as soon as somebody comes along that's more charismatic than a Joseph Smith, all of those people that are inclined towards following charisma, they're going to break off. They're going to go follow the more charismatic person. So it's not very sustainable. You need a Brigham Young to come along and write everything into rules and to structure the hierarchy and to create capital punishment for dissension. In order to have the history of Mormonism that we have, we need all of the parts working in concert together. And yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, Nauvoo was fun. Nauvoo was crazy. Dissent from within was, I mean, proved to be the ultimate downfall of Joseph Smith.
Okay, let's give Marie and Bryce our thanks.